This is Mae Brussel. It is the second side of tape 861, June the 6th, 1988. There's a long article in the San Francisco Chronicle, June 1st, 1988, titled Behind the Long Resume, The Life of George Bush. And it goes into his home, his family, his life in Texas, his war record, CIA director. And the article states it is a constant source of astonishment, as well as anger to his friends and family, that this genuine war hero is sometimes dismissed as a wimp, an unworthy successor to the virile Ronald Reagan, who spent the last war on a Hollywood backlot making training films. Well, the title wimp came to George Bush from the very far right, from Jack Kemp and Gene Kirkpatrick and Newt Gingrich and Richard Vagrie. It came, that original wimpish title came to him because he could not take on with his speechwriters or his big mouth the rhetoric that Ronald Reagan had all of his life or Richard Nixon had against the communists. If you're not talking anti-communism all the time, you're a wimp. You can behave like an anti-communist and do a lot of the dirty dealing which he's done all of his life. But the title came from the very people that are now pushing him for president, but have always been suspicious of him being a wimp compared to Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon. Then the article continues, Bush returned from the war to take his economics degree from Yale University, graduating Phi Beta Kappa in 1948 after serving as captain of the baseball team and being sworn into the secretive, prestigious Skull and Bone Society. Now, the article doesn't say, we know it's a secretive society. I'm not sure how prestigious it is. Yeah, it's prestigious enough. But they don't tell how he got nude inside of a coffin for his initiation or dug up the skull of a famous person to put it in away from the cemetery into the basement at Yale. Why don't they tell a little more about George Bush? Just throwing it out now, so the prestigious Skull and Bones, you'd think it was something like the Phi Beta Kappa, which it isn't. Every year, 15 graduates are selected from Skull and Crossbones, and George Bush was one of them. Now, Ronald Reagan went to Soviet Union, and it got so much coverage. I only want to bring up a few points that you might have seen in the news, but I do want to share with you. And one was he went to see the Refuseniks and invited a member, former member of the Gestapo. The Gestapo doesn't have former members any more than the CIA. The Waffen-SS had a 1,000-year pledge. So when the 1,000 years over, he's a former member of the Gestapo. But the man's name is Nikolai Rozhko, R-O-Z-H-K-O, and he lives in the Belarus section of Russia where the worst atrocities took place, killing the Russian population. And, of course, there have been books on the Belarus secret and stories of the atrocities of that area. And he was responsible for a lot of the Nazi occupation atrocities at that time. It turns out that this Rozhko was originally born in the United States, went to the Soviet Union as a child, joined the Waffen-SS, and was very active as a member of the Waffen-SS. And he's one of the refuseniks who wants to come to this country, come back to the United States because he was born here. And actually, he was sentenced to death by the military tribunal. In 1944, his sentence was commuted to 20 years imprisonment. He was released in 1955, and it would be a tragedy to bring that man to the United States. That's the hero that Ronald Reagan wants to bring to the United States. You can imagine what all the others were if you pick that up. Then the president gave a speech to Mikhail Gorbachev, and he referred to a movie, Friendly Persuasion, and he brought him a copy of the film for him to see at whatever time he wanted. And he didn't mention to Mr. Gorbachev that the man who wrote Friendly Persuasion, his name is Michael Wilson. He was the author of the screenplay. He was blacklisted in Hollywood by Ronald Reagan and his gang out here in Hollywood and Senator Joe McCarthy group, and Reagan was active in the participation of the blacklisting people. He goes there and brings a movie written by Michael Wilson and doesn't tell Gorbachev that this man was accused of being a communist. He refused to speak before the House on American Activities, and in fact, the film that he gave doesn't even have the name of Michael Wilson on it. He wasn't allowed to use his name because of the terror in Hollywood and the book publishers and so forth. And he's bragging about the movie that was made here in Hollywood, and he also is talking in the theme of civil war and the hard choices you have to make. And what Ronald Reagan was telling the Russians, very not too subtly, was egging them on to have a civil war to get your freedom of your press and religion, and eventually we will have enough CIA money to have these dissidents in all the areas of Russia kicking up and kicking ass. And of course, Ronald Reagan is instigating, as he has done for many years, this inside war inside Russia to overthrow that regime. The gift that he took to Gorbachev, the main gift, was a bronze statue of an American cowboy with a rattlesnake in bronze. I don't have to comment. I think you get the meaning of that. And while the American Indians are over there protesting the fact that they've been dislocated, that the American Indian movement is not in their behalf, that they've been mistreated, he's telling the people in Russia that a lot of them sit on a hunk of oil. He doesn't talk about the uranium or plutonium that's under the Aryan flag near Flagstaff, where the Navajos and the Hopis have been displaced, and how the coal companies and the mineral sources are waiting to kill off and move the Indians to utilize all of that. He referred to a few Indians sitting on oil, and the Indians are over there protecting American policies in our country, and he's taking a statue of a cowboy. And what Reagan thinks about when he sees a cowboy is killing the Indians. If you don't know that, just read all the books and movies on the cowboy and Indians and a bronze rattlesnake. Hardly a dub or an image of peace, but a rattlesnake and a cowboy and a movie called Friendly Persuasion about Civil War. Then Reagan went to meet the artists and writers and movie directors and professors, theater managers in the Soviet Union on Tuesday, and there's an article in the LA Times of this dazzling affair. He referred in one of the speeches in Finland to Albert Camus, the writer. They must have been laughing by the time he got over to the Soviet Union. That was a day earlier. And then in one speech, he had quotations from Serge Eisenstein, the director, from a poet, Anna Amatov, another Russian poet, Gumilev, American novelist, William Faulkner, and two or three other Russians. And he was praising the necessity to keep your culture alive, to have free speech, that out of these arts comes understanding. And I'm just paraphrasing the crappy speech he gave. They were all reprinted in the New York Times, but this is what he was telling them. Well, he was just talking about Faulkner, and I recently, just this month, bought a book that came out from research, Tom Davis, called Dangerous Dossiers by Herbert Mitgang. I mentioned it briefly on other broadcasts. And, incidentally, mentioning research and Tom Davis, I'm going to put on the program or type up a sheet of the books that I've gotten recently. There's so many good books, it's hard to update them on the broadcast. But this book is about the FBI keeping dossiers and how hard it was for these people to get jobs, and that the FBI was discrediting Ernest Hemingway because Hemingway called the FBI an American Gestapo. I don't know that Hemingway knew at the time that J. Edgar Hoover was vice president of Interpol, that was headed by Heydrich and the father of the Final Solution, and Heinrich Himmler and the Nazi police, when he referred to a Gestapo. But in the subject of people being followed and discredited and kept from their career, and the contents includes Thomas Wolfe, Dorothy Parker, John O'Hara, Nelson Algren, Dashiell Hammett, Irwin Shaw, Truman Capote, A.J. Liebling, Thornton Wilder, Robert Sherwood, Elmer Rice, Maxwell Anderson, William Saroyan, Lillian Hellman, Tennessee Williams, Archibald MacLeish. These are enemies of the FBI. Robert Lowell, Robert Frost, W.H. Auden, H.L. Mencken, Edmund Wilson, Stephen Spender, Graham Greene, Hannah Arendt, Aldous Huxley, Ignacio Silon. Huxley died a very quiet death the same day that John Kennedy was assassinated, and I believed that they could do him in at that time and not have to worry about it. Also on his list was a Mr. Faulkner, the one that he's quoting here, as being a source of inspiration, and you have to have freedom. And the FBI and the CIA both waged wars against people like Hemingway, Steinbeck, and Faulkner. Isn't that ironic that he's in Russia talking about Faulkner? I'd like to write a letter to the Soviet embassy and send them a copy of this book. What funny speeches he gives, you know, meeting member of the Waffen-SS, and maybe there were two or three more, and not telling him how our CIA and our FBI went against Allen Ginsberg, Norman Mailer, William Mauldin, John Kenneth Galbraith, etc., Alexander Calder, Ben Shahn, George O'Keefe, Henry Moore. Those are some of the people in his marvelous book, Dangerous Dossiers, by Herbert Meitang, who it just came out, and Tom has it at Research. You can get other places, but support his effort to get these books. And here's our president talking about an example of an American writer that people should emulate and have freedom in the Soviet Union, and it's that person that is harassed by the FBI and CIA in this country, and he's telling about friendly persuasion and civil wars and taking a rattlesnake and a cowboy when American Indians are over there telling him our plight. So enough about that, Sama. I think you get the point of what I think about that whole thing, which I can say on a tape. It's not on the air. Is a crock of shit that was formed. It had some purposes, but the Soviet Union, I believe, dragged Reagan over to these peace talks. Earlier, I did broadcast on the belief that the quick Reykjavik summit was because of Danilov's possible involvement in the blowing up of the Chernobyl, knowing people there in the Chernobyl disaster that has never been explored. And another man who's gone into literal obscurity is Mr. Danilov. While the president was at the Danilov Chapel, I don't think if any of you saw his name in all those days, and if there was media coverage, every single station and everyone was there, and as news people and interviewed, and I didn't see hide nor hair of Danilov, good riddance, or Gene Kirkpatrick or William Clark, thank goodness. And I believe that I have to believe that the KGB intelligence is as smart as Mae Brussels. If Mae can figure some of these things out, they can, and they can say, come to Reykjavik, and Nancy was kept home, and Reza Gorbachev was saying how romantic it was to being on a boat with her husband and rubbing it in, and I think that the necessity to talk at this time has as much to do with possible blackmail of the last 8 years as anything there is going. Now, I'm not going to do too much on the individual people running in this election. It'll be Dukakis and Bush after tomorrow, and I'll do more. But there's little things coming out now, and Bush warned he would do them, and the CIA, of course, was the agency that he was the director of. And now there are stories coming out such as the following. Washington Post, May 28th, 1988, by T.R. Reid. Dukakis is called a pagan for his views and for having a Jewish wife. A Senate Republican leader aide, a conservative Republican group, are now circulating an open letter saying that Dukakis is no friend of the Christians. He is a pagan. He uses his membership in the Greek Orthodox Church as a convenient prop for political purposes. The letter, distributed widely in the conservative and Greek American communities, was put out and publicized in the conservative weekly Human Events, and you know that group. It was put at Human Events and by columnists Evans and Novak, you know that team. They say Dukakis is an imposter who attacks our church. Now, this is very significant, the part of Greek Orthodox Church and Dukakis, because the Roman Church, I'll interject this article and go into one second, get back to it. The Roman Church believes that the headquarters of the Roman Empire and the source of God and Jesus is in Rome. And the Greek Orthodox Church, that is now 1,000 years old, believes that the center is in the Soviet Union. And I believe I've done broadcasts and mentioned before on radio programs that the real fight, one of the real fights that is never disclosed openly or delved into in any scholarly manner, is that one of the reasons the Roman Empire has had this diatribe against Russia, even when it was under the Tsar, the wars against Russia and Great Britain and Japan goading Russia in 1905 and in 1914 and again now continuously, is that for once and all for all, the Roman Church wants to wipe out the Greek Orthodox Church. If they took Russia, if we had a war and won Russia, there would be only one head of the Roman Church, and that would be in the Vatican, St. Peter's grave, and the Vatican in Rome, Italy, and they do not like the attention of the Greek Orthodox Church. So the great warmongers, Robert Novak and Roland Evans and Robert Novak, and the magazine Human Events and the Catholics, or the people close to the war machinery, are attacking Dukakis for his links to those inside the Greek church, which is really interesting because if he's not one of the Catholics under John Paul II, then he is a pagan. The article says that Dukakis is an imposter, as I said before, who attacks our church. He attacks Christ. As evidence, the letter notes that Dukakis had opposition to aid for the Nicaraguan Contras. This is actually in the Washington Post. Can you believe it? As evidence that he's a pagan. He opposed aid to the Contras. He is pro-choice on abortion. And he's married to a non-Christian. Not only a non-Christian, but Kitty is Jewish. He's a pagan because he opposes aid to the Contras. The 10-page report was written by James Jatras, J-A-T-R-A-S, and I'd love to get a hold of the 10-page report. He works for Senator William Armstrong, the Republican for Colorado. Now, I could do a whole program or two on Colorado, but we'll continue. Armstrong is on the Senate Republican Policy Committee. Jatras said he distributed hundreds of these letters, of the letter of the Greek Orthodox prelates and the leaders of the Greek American community. And there's an ad hoc committee, the Defense Committee in Defense of Life, based on the anti-abortion group and so forth. A key figure in the ad hoc committee against Dukakis is Joseph Sobran, a conservative columnist who has been accused by Jews of being anti-Semitic. Armstrong said through his spokesman that he is familiar with Jatras' letter. This is a Republican from Colorado, and this is his aide. He decided to write the letter as a private citizen. You've heard this before. The attack on Dukakis drew criticism from other Republicans, such as Frank Fahrenkopf, who said, "We do not believe that religion should be the basis for political attack." Dukakis is a pagan, and his wife is Jewish. And Jatras said in an interview, he tried to point out that Michael Dukakis falsely portrays himself as a member even of the Greek Orthodox Church. He is the son of a Greek immigrant in the U.S. Greek community. There are many types of Greeks. Among the Americans of Greek descent, there is a minority who would support Satan himself if his name ended in A-K-I-S. Among them, they would support Satan himself if it ended with A-K-I-S. And he is saying that he is, because he's married to a non-Christian, and although he was baptized in the Greek Orthodox Church, he's still a pagan, and this is going out. The letter called Dukakis' decision to marry a Jew a rebellion against his own church. And Jatras criticized Dukakis because he has not baptized his own children in the church, having married a Jewish woman. So that's a little part of the uglier side of what's going on in the campaigns. It reminds me of the prodigals of elders of Zion. The surgery for Dukakis' wife is, we'll just assume that that is what they said it was, that she had this trouble with the discs in her back, and write that off as a disconcerting event that will keep her from campaigning with him, where wives along with their husbands make a good appearance, and she was diagnosed as having a herniated disc. It's just a coincidence, nothing else. We chalk these up to coincidence. Just add them up. And when Gerald Ford was, just the time he was appointed president by crook Richard Nixon, I always refer to that transfer of powers, the crook giving it to Ford of the Warren Commission. Betty Ford went into the hospital. She was told immediately she had cancer of the breast and went into the hospital. And shortly after those events, she started to require drugs for pain, and the rest, you know what happened to her. And when Nelson Rockefeller was made vice president, very quickly, Happy Rockefeller was sent in and had her breast removed and was told she had cancer. Women who have weekly or month, not weekly, yearly checkups and pretty good medical care that they can afford are in some way mutilated and removed from the scene as these men move into power. And if I wanted to be very much a conspiracy theorist, I would say this would be a good chance to have the men alone while the women are out of the way to set down the ground rules and get it firmly into their crazy heads before the little lady comes around and changes these matters and can influence them. As a matter of fact, Reagan was only president for 60 days, inaugurated in the 21st of January, and shot the 30th of March, and Nancy stayed close to him. They didn't remove her from the scene. If she had been sick then, later she did have a cancer operation and also had a breast removed. There seems to be a certain type of inconvenience in mingling among these people, but again, that's all, that's what you call a conspiracy theorist. That isn't hard work, that's just a little thought I'm sharing with you. Now, Gore Vidal wrote a article for Interview Magazine, and it was quoted in the Chronicle, June the 2nd, 1988, and they just had a two-sentence quote from Interview, and I want to share with you what Gore Vidal said, because, of course, he studies American politics very closely, even though he lives in Italy now, and it is apropos of elections in 1988 and why I don't take it too seriously. Who wins the primaries California tomorrow? I'll vote, but I really couldn't care less because it all waters down to the same people advising the same whoever wins. I've said that before. I care about some things, like the choices of the justices of the Supreme Court, so I vote Democratic. But the elections are a complete fraud, and they have been since the last election in 1960 when John Kennedy's head was blown off. Now, this is what Gore Vidal said, and this says it's very much like the very first published article on Watergate that I wrote in 1972. There are two governments. There is the National Security Government, which was put in place by the National Security Act of 1947. That is the real government of our country. Then there is the cosmetic government, the government for show, the ongoing presidential government and Congress, which is totally meaningless now. And if ever it was meaningless, was after the Iran-Contra affair, when the powers that be called in John Tower and Mr. Scowcroft from Kissinger Associates and Edmund Muskie, there's a wimp if I ever saw one, and they covered up in the Tower report, named after the man who helped bring Marina Oswald into this country, accompanying Lee. The Tower report says there's nothing wrong with the National Security Council. A few people went astray, and even now, it seems that maybe all these cases are going to be thrown out. Nothing is moving, and certainly the use of the NSC and not the individuals who are elected to advise the president won't come up in any way, shape, or form, even if there is a prosecution. This past week, there has been a series of movies on Robert Kennedy, on his assassination, exposés of the assassination, the family get-togethers, and today they had a mass on the anniversary of his murder in Washington, D.C. And on one of the segments of the television series titled Who Really Killed Robert Kennedy, the writer Dan Moldea, M-O-L-D-E-A, was interviewed at great length. Moldea wrote the book The Hoffa Wars. He wrote other books. That came out in 1978. Now, it turns out Moldea has been spent a lot of time with Thane Caesar, the security guard who's been named on the television shows as possibly having pulled the second gun and possibly having killed Robert Kennedy. Thane Caesar, they didn't mention what came from Lockheed. The TV show said he was a security guard. Lockheed, of course, is part of the CIA program. It's heavily part of the Defense Department and CIA, which is different than just being a private security guard. And Moldea said, yes, Thane Caesar pulled a gun from behind Robert Kennedy at the Vassar Hotel. And he said, now, Caesar never had any experience like in Vietnam. He's never been in war or battle. So it could have been that Caesar pulled the gun from his holster and put out the shots that caused Robert Kennedy to die. This is Moldea saying this. But then there's no proof that he wanted to kill Robert Kennedy. Now, Luke McKissick, the attorney for Sirhan, and one of the many ones, stated publicly, and I've had this on before, that if there were two guns and one killed Robert Kennedy, this was a coincidence. They didn't know each other. And, of course, when the House Select Committee finished their work on the Kennedy assassination, they concluded that if there was somebody behind the fence or the Dow Tex building or in the book depository, the second gunman, if there were only two or three, didn't know each other. It was not a conspiracy. It was a coincidence. You know, these stories really stretch your mind and your brains, and maybe this is one of the reasons I'm ready to go off the air and write just to put down in writing my feelings about some of these people and their muddled logic, the logic of that Commander Park who trained Chung, the pilot, the logic of Moldea. Now, if Thane Caesar pulled a gun and shot Robert Kennedy from behind, suppose he did that. Suppose he's a security guard. Well, the police would want to know why a security guard panicked. It would be shocking that he killed the candidate for presidency of the United States, but why did he panic? And so they would have wanted the gun. Other people saw this gun there. Why did the LAPD then destroy the ceiling panels that showed the direction of Caesar's bullets? Why did they cut off the sleeve of Robert Kennedy's coat and throw it away? Why did that happen? Why did they take out parts of the door that would show where extra bullets were? And why did they let Thane Caesar sell his gun and somebody get rid of it and not match it to the bullets that were inside Robert Kennedy or other parts of the room where it went? So if it was simply a coincidence, the greatest coincidence in the world, that a security guard killed the senator, you might say, "Guard, what are your politics? Oh, you like George Wallace. What do you think of Kennedy? I hate him. How bad do you hate him? Very bad." That's what Thane Caesar said. Hated the Kennedys. Very bad. And he was closely aligned to the very, very far right element that also hated the two Kennedy brothers. So now, if there has to be a second gun, Moldea is saying that forget Thane Caesar because he didn't intend to do it. This is hardly the way to conduct an investigation. And the most disgusting part of this, again, is the family of Robert Kennedy. They listed the children that would be at the services, 10 children that would be at Arlington today. Robert Kennedy Jr., married, father of two children, works in environmental law, teaches at Pace University, and doesn't care who killed his father. Courtney Kennedy Rue of New York, married, treasurer of Joe Kennedy's congressional committee, and runs the Robert Kennedy Foundation, and doesn't care who murdered her father. Michael Kennedy Jr. of Boston, married, president of Citizens Energy, a nonprofit company, provides low-cost oil for the poor and elderly, went to the mass, and doesn't care who murdered his father. Carrie Kennedy graduated from Boston College Law School, set up and runs the Kennedy Center for Human Rights in Boston, and could care less who murdered her father. Christopher Kennedy, 24, works the Merchandise Mart in Chicago and doesn't give a damn who killed his father. Then the one that's named, this is the really great name, one along the line, third from the youngest, 23, Matthew Maxwell Taylor Kennedy, now a senior at Harvard. Isn't that a slap to look into the covert actions and counterintelligence, the kind from Lockheed and the YouTube program that Thane Caesar was a part of? They could say Matthew Kennedy. The others, they don't put the two middle names. Maxwell Taylor, the great CIA covert operator. Who would be proud of that name? He certainly was with all the people who knew about who killed, Taylor's dead now, but who had killed his father. Douglas Kennedy, 21, a sophomore at Boston College, doesn't care who killed his father. Rory Kennedy, 19, is a sophomore at Brown University. She was born 6 months after her father was killed. Those are 10 children, all good education, all want to be political, all want to save the world, worried about energy, worried about keeping the museum going, worried about human rights. Human rights are going down the drain. We're getting the shaft all across the board, the American citizens, the poor, the blacks, the Indians, the arrogants, and they all assembled to say a prayer, which is their privilege, and not one of them, not a single one of them, with all their education and brain cell, has asked a question. Who killed Daddy? Is he alive? Are they alive? Why did they get away with it? We don't want vengeance, but we want the history straight. And they might ask a few questions about who killed Uncle John. John was killed and they were close. These kids were little, but a lot of them remember him. Not who killed Uncle John and Daddy. It's so obvious. And who put, you know, Uncle Ted in that accident, Chappaquiddick. How these people continue and act like nothing happened is pathetic, given their education, etc. This is Mae Bressel. I'll be back with you next week, continuing along with some of these horrendous, I always call them, horrendous stories.